विदास्यामि
तेषां विदास्यामि
तस्य कामं न कुर्यात्
तस्य कामं न कुर्यात्
सिद्धिस्त्रय भार्गिति यथा
सिद्धिस्त्रय भार्गिति यथा.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O afflicted one, I shall forthwith gratify whatever desire is dear to you, for who else but you is the source of the three perfections of liberation? Please repeat. O afflicted one, I shall forthwith gratify whatever desire is dear to you. For who else but you is the source of the three perfections of liberation? Purport. The three perfections of liberation are religiosity, economic development, and sense gratification. For a conditioned soul, the wife is considered to be the source of liberation because she offers her service to the husband for his ultimate liberation. Conditional material existence is based on sense gratification. And if someone has the good fortune to get a good wife, he is helped by the wife in all respects. If one is disturbed in his conditional life, he becomes more and more entangled in material contamination. A faithful wife is supposed to cooperate with her husband in fulfilling all material desires so that he can then become comfortable and execute spiritual activities for the perfection of life. If, however, the husband is progressive in spiritual advancement, the wife undoubtedly shares in his activities, and thus both the wife and the husband profit in spiritual perfection. It is essential, therefore, that girls as well as boys be trained to discharge spiritual duties so that at the time of cooperation, both will be benefited. The training of the boy is brahmacharya, and the training of the girl is chastity. A faithful wife and a spiritually trained brahmachari are a good combination for advancement of the human mission. O afflicted one, I shall forthwith gratify whatever desire is dear to you, for who else but you is the source of the three perfections of liberation? So the time of cooperation, that's the key. It's inevitable that men and women are attracted to each other. That's the material world. That's the bondage of material life. That one living being is attracted to another living being for the purpose of sense gratification or enjoying one's senses. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. That attraction is natural because attraction, of course, Krishna is all attractive, and attraction therefore exists between all the living beings that are parts and parcels of Krishna. Everybody has the same quality as God, but nobody has the same quantity as God. So, in understanding how to deal with attraction, that's the trick. Krishna is the all-attractive, and we are the ones that are being attracted. Krishna is not attracted to anyone because he's self-sufficient, because sometimes he becomes attracted to himself, but that's another principle. If God is all attractive, then logically he must be attracted to himself. Yeah, otherwise it's not God. But as far as other living beings are concerned, they're being attracted by a higher principle or by a greater principle. That is natural. It is not that we are naturally all attractive ourselves, so we don't command attraction. Rather, we become attracted. Yeah, submissive, or it's a subservient principle, attraction. The principle of attraction amongst ordinary living beings is that it dictates to us. Krishna, with his attraction, dictates to every other living being. But an ordinary living being is dictated to by the principle of attraction. So in that way, then, we have to be very, very careful in the material world, what we become attracted to, and how we deal with that attraction. Yeah. We can't avoid that principle, but it requires a proper understanding what it actually, what its source is, where it comes from, and how it is to be dealt with properly. So in Bhakti Yoga, at least, there is a method for dealing with even mundane attraction. Here, of course, it's mentioned that even mundane attraction can become a principle of liberation if it's based in the right context. Three principles he's mentioning here. One of them, of course, is dharma, then artha and karma. Yeah, that when you have a proper basis for human life, which is dharma, religious activity, that means it's structured, it's directed properly, it has an intent. And the purpose of that is to bring one to a point of satisfaction by artha, or by the economic principle, or not necessarily just the economic principle, but the principle of wealth, the principle of opulence. That's artha, however you get it. Then by having sufficient means, then you can gratify your senses, or your senses can be gratified, let's put it that way. Yeah, you can't always get what you want, but you can get what you need. Yeah, that's the principle. That karma doesn't necessarily mean lusty desires, although it's generally, that's the principle in the material world, that I have these strong desires and I want to fulfill them at any cost. Yeah, and generally the cost is at the expense of somebody else, because that's the principle of lust, just plain ordinary lust, is that it becomes a principle not of satisfaction, but a principle of exploitation. That I get lusty, and there's an object that I'm lusting over, and I must have it, and I manipulate things in such a way to get it, and then that object, maybe a person, because generally speaking, it has to be a person, because the whole idea, again, is relationship or attraction. So I have to manipulate that person that I'm attracted to in order to gratify my senses. So automatically there's a principle of exploitation that's involved in trying to exercise that idea of attraction as a principle, you know, for myself, for my own enjoyment, rather than giving that enjoyment to Krishna. We try to exploit another living being, bring that living being into a position, you know, where I can manipulate them. And then whatever my desires are, then I try to extract from them, you know, that principle of enjoyment. And the end result, of course, is that it ends in problems. It ends in a disaster, because exploitation means that somebody is being unfairly dealt with. Yeah, that being put at a disadvantage in order for one living being to extract their enjoyment, the other living being actually has to suffer. They have to be, you know, forced into doing something that they might not necessarily want to do. So that's the principle that we see that's going on in the material world. It's always this exploitative principle, competition, you know, manipulation, subduing somebody else, and somehow or another making them do what I want. But because a person is not naturally the enjoyer, then even if they get what they want, it's not what they want. It leaves them feeling, you know, still unsatisfied. They get no pleasure from it. And you'll see that people that are very manipulative, they're actually very unhappy, because they don't know how to give. They only know how to try to control and, you know, exploit. But if you're in that mood, you never get any real satisfaction. It doesn't satisfy the heart. And the satisfaction that one gets through the senses is very limited and temporary. So you're left feeling, you know, frustrated. And then due to ignorance, because of frustration, then the same activity is repeated again and again and again to more and more extreme degrees. There's no limits to it. Yeah. So then people will go to practically any end to gratify their senses. They'll kill any other living being, you know, they'll exploit them, they'll make them slaves, you know, they'll force them in so many different ways to try to get or extract some, you know, what we use in English, because they're brought up on Shakespearean lore. So you get your pound of flesh. Yeah. Shylock. There's a play there where Merchant of Venice, where a man is, he signs a contract that he has no money, and he goes to a moneylender, and the moneylender pretends to be his friend, and then he signs away, he says, yes, if I can't pay back this money that I'm borrowing, then I'll give you a pound of flesh. So then the moneylender, he makes out, I'm just, you know, we'll just, it's nominal, because I would never take your pound of flesh, you know, that would be ridiculous. You just go and do your business, you pay me back, like that, don't worry, everything will be alright. And then when the man can't pay the money back, then the moneylender actually attempts to extract his pound of flesh, because he gets tricked in the end, because he's told if you take a pound of flesh, alright, you're welcome to it, but there's no mention of any blood. So if you spill one drop of blood, then we have you. Then you'll be prosecuted. So then he was prevented. It was a trick. But anyway, the point is that, you know, extracting your pound of flesh, yeah, extreme measures to get your sense gratification. And you see that all over the world. Yeah. Nowadays, of course, a couple of hundred years ago, there was a massive trade in slavery. Yeah, especially in the African countries, millions, literally tens of millions of people were extracted from that country and sent to so many other countries in the world as slaves. And, you know, they were indentured. They had to do whatever they were ordered to do. And very often they were, you know, worked until they literally died. I remember reading a story about how when in America, then, you know, they brought about the end of slavery, and then all the blacks that were in the plantations, they were set free, so they had to start registering and, you know, get this so-called citizenship rights, etc. And there was a story how they went and they were taking the fingerprints of all the workers, but they couldn't take them because they had none. They were working so hard, they literally had no fingerprints left. Their skin was so worn down by the hard work, so they had to, you know, give them a couple of months break so that their fingerprints would return. Anyway, that's just a little example. I mean, what to speak about the extreme stuff. But there's lots of slavery that's still going on. Nowadays, there's a lot about slavery of women, exploitation of women, that, you know, we live in so-called free societies where, you know, there's so-called free rights or equal rights, actually not equal. And what's happening is that there's a massive worldwide trade in smuggling and exploiting young women. Yeah, they end up in brothels all around the world. They're tricked, you know, they're offered a job in one country like Lithuania, and then they're told, now you just go to England or France or some other place, and when you arrive there, we have a room for you, and we have, you know, a nice job for you, and you'll earn money, you can send it back to your family like this. And then when they arrive, they take the passports off them, and then they end up in a brothel. And then they spend the rest of their lives, you know, just being exploited like that. And that's not just, you know, a small thing. They estimate that there are literally millions of girls around the world that are being exploited like this. Here in Bengal also, it's a big thing. Girls suddenly go missing. There's hundreds of thousands of young girls that just go missing every year. and nobody knows what happens to them. But what happens to them generally is that they end up, you know, in some bar or something in Mumbai or Delhi or some other place, and they just get exploited. So it's another form of slavery. But the principle of it is the same. It's this idea of exploitation, the idea of, you know, one living being trying to extract their sense gratification at the expense of another living being. And the end result of it all is misery. So especially this principle of attraction between male and female has to be handled very carefully. That is, Prabhupada explains, that is the strongest point of material existence, that sex attraction. Misapplication of the principle of attraction for one's own gratification. And everybody's doing it to everybody else. It's not, let's say, like the men are doing it to the women. The women are also trying to exploit the men for their own sense gratification as well. Each one is trying to exploit the other. So if they come together at all, it's just simply on the principle that, you know, I can gratify your senses, you can gratify my senses, and as long as that gratification, you know, is being achieved, we'll stay together. And then as soon as we don't get the gratification that we want anymore, then we immediately break up and then we go off and we go and look for another relationship. And then in the meantime, because of the combination, you know, there's other living beings that become involved, there's families, there's children, and then those children, if the parents break up, it becomes a very big disaster in their lives. Actually, most kids that have had to go through, you know, seeing their parents get divorced, it's very, very traumatic for them. Because they lose the shelter, they lose the confidence that they have, they lose the protection that they were offered by the family unit. So it leaves them psychologically very much disturbed. So in that way, if there's not a proper structure in human society for the business of cooperation, Prabhupada says here, the business of one living being coming together with another living being in a very intimate relationship. So if there's no structure for that, if there's no real purpose for that, higher purpose, then the whole system breaks down into just, you know, a system of exploitation and misery. That's the end result. Everybody becomes disturbed. So, in human society at least, anyway, there has to be some progressive method so that people can deal with each other in a respectful way, not in an exploitative way. So, that is educated right from the very beginning, because that's the Varnashram system, that on this basis of these three principles that he's mentioning here, that religiosity, economic development, and sense gratification. You can live peacefully if you do it in a controlled fashion. So, especially boys and girls, as soon as they hit puberty, then it's a very difficult time, because you have the mind of a child and the body of an adult. That's the difficulty. You don't have the experience, you don't have the knowledge to be able to deal with the things that are happening within your own body. And therefore, you're advised to take shelter of those that have that experience. And then with their guidance, with their protection, the propensities that are coming out within your own body, they can be directed in a constructive way so that you'll actually become happy. This is the idea. So in Vedic society, before kids hit puberty, it was to be expected that they would already be engaged or married. Yeah. In fact, Prabhupada told us one time on a morning walk here in Mayapur that his wife threatened to commit suicide because he hadn't yet got his daughter married and she was 16 years old. So, you know, it was such an imperative thing. And he said that there's even in one Shastra it's mentioned that if the father doesn't get the daughter married by the time she has her first menstruation, he has to eat that menstrual fluid. for emphasis. The idea is that it's so important, actually, that boys and girls, you know, get married and get put into a nice cooperative situation, a situation which will actually help them to develop their spiritual life. And if that's not arranged, then what will happen is that they'll become exploited. And Prabhupada always used to point out that especially the women become exploited. Yeah, if they're left to their own ends, as you know, Western society does nowadays, then what will happen is some, you know, lusty man will come along, attract the girl, trick her in so many ways, use her for some time, and then as soon as she becomes pregnant, dump her, and go off and get somebody else. And in the meantime, she's literally left holding the baby. Or nowadays, they say, no, no need to hold the baby anymore, you can abort the baby. Yeah, you can kill it. So what a choice is that? So therefore, Prabhupada said, the Western system is very exploitative. Although, when the Westerners, they look at the Vedic system and they, oh, what is this? The girls have to be married when they're 12 or 14 years old. Oh, this is exploitation. Just right now, actually, in America, there's a Christian sect. Their belief is, they believe in polygamy. So they've just busted their ranch there and they have several hundred girls that they've liberated. And their propaganda is that now these girls have been taught, you know, that they have to be submissive and serve, you know, whatever husbands are found for them. And this is, you know, very horrifying. This is, you know, horrible exploitation. Of course, I'm not commenting on that particular sect and whether what they're doing is right or wrong. But the principle that young girls should somehow or another be married, you know, at a very young age, oh, that's very horrifying. No, we should let them loose. Yeah, let them loose on society. Let them bounce from one man to another. Yeah, let them be exploited as much as possible. And in that way, then eventually, if they're lucky, they might find somebody that they can actually live with. That's actually the Western system. Yeah, have many, many different partners until you find one that you can actually live with. Hit and miss. And in the meantime, you get exploited in so many different ways and used. Yeah. So, therefore, you know, there's so many abortions, there's so many broken marriages, and the statistics are actually, if you look at them, quite horrifying, you know, for marriage. Even in India nowadays, it's coming as well. But how many marriages break down? At least 70% in some countries. No stability. Yeah, everybody's just exploiting each other. Everybody's in competition with each other. All on this basis of this principle of attraction. And not being able to control it properly. Not being able to direct it properly. So the Vedic system is to, all right, recognize the principle is there. But by very careful social arrangements, then you bring the two parties together in a spirit of cooperation and in such a way that they'll actually be able to live together peacefully and execute the real purpose of human life. Because if you're very disturbed, you forget about what the real principle is. You forget that there's a higher principle in life. You just become so overwhelmed, with distressful conditions that the intelligence actually can't work anymore. It becomes too much disturbed. And then you can't think anymore. You see anybody, when they get into a distressful condition, they just become depressed. Depression means you can't see anything. You can't see any future. Yeah, you just become overwhelmed with the immediate problems. You become beset with them. And then there's no progress. But if you're living peacefully, then you can actually see the future. You can make plans. You can, you know, cooperate with others. You can see what the goal is. You can plan out, you know, how to act in such ways to achieve that goal. So peace is a requirement to live very peacefully, not to live very disturbed. So peaceful living, how to get that? and especially in marriage, because the whole principle of human society is, you know, there is an institution called marriage, and what is it for? It's so that one can actually become peaceful. So that one can take these propensities, these desires that we have automatically within the heart, but handle them in such a way that they actually become an impetus, you know, for our own benefit, for our own development. So how to do that? Marriage, that is advice. That by taking responsibility, by being matched up with somebody that you're actually capable of living with and who's capable of living with you. Therefore, Prabhupada said in human society, astrology, any human civilization, Prabhupada says, they use astrology to match up the boys and the girls. Because the science of astrology enables you to see the character of that particular living entity, to see their propensities, and you can match them with somebody with similar or compatible propensities. And if they're compatible, that means you can live together. And if you're incompatible, even if you're good individually, you become bad when the combination takes place. I was with Prabhupada on a couple of occasions when he got a letter from a devotee that had recently taken sannyas. He'd had a very troubled relationship with his wife, and then eventually he took sannyas, and then individually, both of them, they wrote to Prabhupada and said how they were now living very peacefully and doing their Krishna consciousness. So when he got the letter from the man, Prabhupada wrote back to him, he said, yes. He said, I have a new saying. Man is good, woman is good. But when they combine together, they become bad. So that was his experience, at least in the Western context, because the marriages were not, you know, planned, they were not scientifically arranged. Yeah. Then the end result was that they just become bad. Everybody just becomes disturbed, and then even their spiritual lives also become disturbed. So the idea is that the combination has to be done in a proper way, in a structured way. So astrology is one way of doing that. You look at the charts, you figure out the compatibilities, and then the parent's duty is to seek out a suitable partner, especially for the girls, but for the boys also, to find out somebody that they'll actually be able to live with. Of course, astrology is one aspect of it. Social standing is another. How the person is living, what the family situation is, whether there's a compatibility in outlook, yeah, in terms of the social living, etc. And the parents have a responsibility to be involved in that. So it's not that every marriage is arranged and the child, you know, has to just do blindly whatever the parents say either. There are different standards in Vedic culture. It's not that there was only one standard. Because Prabhupada, you know, sometimes he mentions that even in, you know, his childhood, his sister was married when she was 11 years old. Prabhupada's own wife was only 11 years old when she got married to him. He was 22, so 11 years difference. Prabhupada said that's an ideal difference in ages, 11 years between the man and the woman. Because then the man, he can take a leading role, he can provide protection, he can provide, you know, the economic basis for the family to live peacefully, look after the children. And the woman can serve nicely and be sheltered and cooperate nicely. But even if that's not there, then Prabhupada mentions that there are different standards. Arranging a marriage is one thing, but there's also other standards, just like Daksha. He had so many daughters. So he asked them, who do you want to marry? So that's another system. It's not, you know, all right, you just marry this person, finish. Yeah. But there's another system. All right, who do you want to marry? And then the girls, they picked out, well, I like this one or this one or this one. I've heard about this one. Of course, they've never met their husbands. Like Kasyapa Muni, he married 13 daughters. So they'd never met him, but they all picked him because they'd heard about his qualities. And so they were attracted. So then the parents then made the arrangement. Daksha made the arrangements. All right, my daughters, these daughters would like to marry you. Would you like to marry them? And, you know, it was done under supervision. So that's another system. There's another system called the Gandhava marriage, which I'm not sure is exactly bona fide or not, but there is a system. It is a bona fide system where a man and woman meet and the principle of attraction is there and they exchange garlands and some words and then they're considered to be married. And there's different systems. So not just one system. And according to the time, place and circumstance, you know, one system may become prevalent or not. But still, the whole idea is that the society is structured in such a way as to support, you know, whatever system is present. The Prabhupada, when he went to the West, he, you know, started to encourage his boys and girls that were joining his movement to get married. And at the same time, he was saying that I'm not, you know, going to enforce certain things because your culture is different. In India, you know, the system is arranged marriage. But he said, I know that in your, you know, in your system it's different. Boys and girls mix freely, so I'm not going to enforce that. You'll see there's many letters where Prabhupada mentions that. And but at the same time, he was saying that still, whatever system you have, the principle is that you should serve Krishna. The man should serve Krishna, the woman should serve Krishna. And then even if there's some problems within the relationships, if you're both serving Krishna, then they'll automatically be adjusted. Yeah? Because there's a higher principle involved. So that's really the business. Because marital relationships are very important, there's no doubt. But they're not the be-all and end-all of everything. The whole purpose of, you know, that relationship or any other kind of relationship is that you have to come to the point of establishing your relationship with Krishna, with the supreme all-attractive principle. Not that the attraction between, you know, man and wife, well, that becomes supreme. And then everything else is reduced or subordinate to that. If a man and woman comes together, naturally there'll be some attraction, and there should be some attraction. Yeah. If you don't like who you're married to, then you can have problems. You actually have to like them. Prabhupada says that you know, there is a principle of attraction, and you know, it's natural that there'll be some affection between the husband and wife. There has to be that. Otherwise, why would you stay together? And there's affection between the parents and the children. That's natural. But if everybody is working on the principle of serving Krishna, if everybody's working on the same goal, that our real benefit is our relationship with the Supreme Lord. That's our goal in life. That's, you know, where we're really going to get our satisfaction from. Then any discrepancies in the ordinary relationship can automatically be adjusted very easily. Because everybody knows, all right, you know, we're all here for the higher purpose. And the husband helps the wife to serve Krishna, the wife helps the husband to serve Krishna. There's a cooperation for a common mutual benefit. So that's what cooperation means, that you work together for a benefit that both of you can share. And if it's spiritual life, of course, you know, then there's complete satisfaction from that. If it's a material goal, then when that goal is attained, then you know, you may then have a divergence of views again, and then again there'll be problems. But a spiritual goal is something that you work for your entire life. So on the principle of a spiritual marriage, Krishna conscious marriage, Prabhupada said if the husband and wife are actually cooperating together nicely, and they're both getting the benefit of becoming Krishna conscious from that combination, there's no need to break it. You can remain married for the rest of your life. It's not that you have to take, you know, sannyas or whatever to break away from that entanglement. Because if the principle is Krishna conscious, then there is no entanglement. Each partner realizes, oh, my wife is a part and parcel of Krishna. I'm helping her to serve Krishna and develop her relationship with Krishna. the wife is seeing the husband in the same way. So then that cooperation is for mutual benefit of both. It's freed of any exploitation, and it's freed from any, you know, material entanglement. Both are looking to go back home, back to Godhead. And at the same time, you can actually, you know, live together, serve together. You can like each other. That's allowed. It's not that you're not supposed to like each other. Or the, you know, the wife is Maya, or the husband is Maya. No. You can actually like other devotees, including your own wife and kids. Yeah. And not be entangled. Yeah. Sometimes we've seen in our Krishna consciousness movement, you know, some misunderstandings about this whole principle of attraction, this principle of, you know, cooperating together, and especially between male and female, because we put a lot of emphasis on renunciation, not getting entangled. We put a lot of emphasis on that, but sometimes that's misapplied. You know, it's used in such a way as to, you know, or it's used in a negative way, you know, because, how can I put it? Because a person, he doesn't want to get entangled, yeah, but he's immature in his realization, so he doesn't know how to deal with another living being. Yeah, so then the effect is very negative. Put them down, get rid of them, you know, no women allowed in this temple. You know, men and women can't chant japa together, or, you know, exile them to this place or that. That, you know, of course, some of our ladies, they had that experience that, you know, there was a very negative connotation from that principle of, you know, so-called renunciation, that then that, you know, they would, you know, dealt with very harshly in so many different ways. You know, they were disturbed in their own development of their own Krishna consciousness, because there was not a mature understanding of how to have that relationship. A mature understanding is that you see each other as spirit souls, and you serve each other in order to serve Krishna. You know, you make arrangements for each other so that you can enter into your relationship with Krishna more and more. That is a situation of cooperation. And a situation of exploitation, yeah, means either attraction or rejection, that impulse, where I try to manipulate you in one way or another. Either I try to bring you close so that I can extract something from you, or I keep you out, I kick you out, and get, you know, make you, I exclude you. So Krishna consciousness is meant to be a system of cooperation, where you see the relationships in the proper perspective. And if you do that, if you see the relationships as they actually are, spiritual relationships, it doesn't matter who you're with. Yeah? It doesn't matter who you're working with. Men and women together can work together in a cooperative way. So Prabhupada, he was sometimes criticized by his godbrothers. Why you're allowing ladies to live in the temples, you know, of so-called Brahmacharini ashram. Yeah. I think before Srila Prabhupada started preaching, there was no such thing as a Brahmacharini ashram, at least not, you know, in the Gaudiya map, they certainly didn't have that. Yeah. But Prabhupada created Brahmacharini ashrams, and he was criticized very heavily for that. Oh, just see, he's got his, all these young women living in the temples like this. But Prabhupada, he explained that because both the boys and the girls are fully engaged in devotional service, they're going out preaching, selling books, looking after the deities, and they're fully absorbed in devotional activities, then there's nothing wrong with that. According to the climate in the West, you can't separate boys and girls artificially, it's not possible. So let them come together, but let them work for the higher principle. And he said, as long as that's done, then there'll be no disturbance. But if you lose sight of the higher principle, of course, then there's lots of disturbance, and we've had that too. So we have to get a balance. You have to, you know, find out what the platform of real cooperation is, and you have to handle it very, very carefully, yeah, like fire. If you handle fire nicely, then it warms you, and you can utilize it in so many beneficial ways for cooking or heating or lighting or whatever. But if you don't handle it properly, then, you know, it can break out into a huge blaze and just literally reduce everything to ashes. Yeah. So we have to handle that principle of attraction in a very, very careful way. Otherwise, it can be like that blazing fire that gets out of control. So anyway, here he's saying that a wife is actually a principle for liberation, a good wife. I have to satisfy you in all respects because my combination with you is going to lead to a higher principle. So this is a different kind of relationship than the ordinary mundane relationships. Vedic relationships, dharma, artha, karma, moksha. You go through these progressive stages based on religion, based on dharma, based on, you know, not just whimsical acts, but based on structured acts and rules and regulations. And if you do that, you'll get the satisfaction that you need to live, and at the same time, you'll keep your goal on the higher principle, so that that moksha comes at the end of it. So he's looking, he's seeing his wife, Aditi, and he's telling her, all right, you're a little disturbed right now, but I shall certainly satisfy you, because if I don't, then our relationship will become disturbed. And if our relationship is disturbed, then how will we make any progress in our spiritual lives? We're married, so we have to have some cooperation between the two of us. So even though he knew at this point this was not a correct thing for his wife to approach him at this particular time or in this particular circumstance, he took a higher principle that overall the principle of our being happily married is more important. All right, this one incident may create a little problem. He certainly knew that. He was educated enough to know that. But overall, if I reject you, that will be an even bigger problem. Yeah. So he's trying to deal with this awkward situation in such a way that, you know, their ultimate purpose remains. Yeah. Not that on the basis of some immediate thing, then there'll be a, you know, all right, get out of my house, get lost. You're irreligious. So he didn't chastise her like that. He had to deal with it in a very, very careful way. So we'll see how that goes, you know, as this progresses, of course. Any questions or comments? We go for a bit. Yeah, the question is, did Prabhupada want a system where the girls are married very young? In the future. Maybe not right now. It would certainly be helpful if we had a society that supported a system, you know, where girls were married when they, you know, get to the age of puberty. Because Prabhupada said that, I mean, he points out that as soon as puberty comes, the impulse is there and it's difficult to control. Yeah, it's just, for boys and girls, it's just very, very difficult to control. And that's where the parents come in, to provide an environment, you know, whereby they can go through that stage, transiting from being young and inexperienced to becoming mature adults. So if it's handled properly, then you get a stable society. And if it's not handled properly, then you get a very disturbed society. So that, you know, what we call the teenage years, it's very, very troublesome for everybody. It's troublesome for the kids themselves, and it's troublesome for the parents. Unless you actually have a really nice societal structure. So, Vedic society, everybody, you know, had the same idea. that, all right, you cannot stop boys and girls becoming attracted to each other. It's not possible. The impulse is there. It comes at a certain point, the sex impulse comes about. The hormones in the body changes. That means the mind changes, the body changes in the way that it works. And then you have to deal with it. So if you direct it nicely, you find a good partner for the boy, a good partner for the girl, their minds become settled because they become focused on that person. This is going to be my husband, or this is going to be my wife. Then their mind, you know, even it may jump a little bit here and there to others, but actually it's directed to this one person that they're going to live with. And the parents have chosen the partner very carefully, you know, by astrology and other things. So they know, once they get together, they'll like it. They'll be satisfied with each other. So that way then, you know, they can be directed in a proper way, and you'll get a very stable human society. But if you just say, all right, just go out, whatever boy or girl that you happen to bump into on the street, you know, have a go, see what it's like, they'll be finished. They'll become so disturbed. You know, by the time that they become mature adults, their ability to have a stable relationship will be finished. Then they'll spend the rest of their lives trying to, you know, readjust, getting into a relationship where they can become stable. Yeah, but because they weren't put into a stable relationship right from the very beginning, then afterwards, you know, when they are adults and they have to look after themselves, it becomes really, really difficult. So Prabhupada did suggest to us that, you know, we could follow the Vedic system, but only if the law allows. And in places where it's not allowed, then you can't go against, you know, the local laws. So at least most places, girls can be married legally by the age of 16, or some places now it's 18. And then after that, then it's nice if they can find a good boy, capable, you know, qualified person, who they're compatible with, and they can, you know, get married and then live very, very peacefully and execute their Krishna consciousness like that. But at the same time, Prabhupada did say that if that's not possible, still if they're engaged in devotional activities, then they'll develop a taste for their spiritual life, they'll develop some sense of control over their senses and their minds. So even if they wait a little later, that's not, you know, necessarily a bad thing. But there has to be some discipline, there has to be some check on it. So marriage is one way of checking, you know, the lusty impulses that are naturally there. Spiritual practices are another way of checking it. And if you can combine the two together, then you're in a perfect situation. So, you know, Prabhupada wasn't against, you know, girls and boys getting married when they're young, but only if the rest of the society supports it. Yeah. If they get married when they're young and then there's no support from, you know, the rest of the community, that also becomes a big problem. And that system also can become a system of exploitation, as we've seen. You know, there's, you know, I mean, that was why there's so many complaints about child marriages and why the law has been changed in India against so-called child marriages, because that also became exploitative. Just like the idea of dowry. What was the idea of a dowry? It means that, generally speaking, a woman is expensive to maintain. Street. The principle is street, that ladies have children. So as soon as there's a combination, the man is the provider, the woman is the nurturer. And so the man has to find the ways and means to support the wife, and the children come from their combination. Yeah, there's an expansion by that combination. So the man, you know, he requires some help, especially at the very beginning. Yeah, if he's a young man, he hasn't had a chance to establish himself in business or, you know, establish his means of livelihood. So the idea was that when the girl came, you know, to live with her new husband, the parents of the girl would provide a dowry. It means some, you know, material means just to get them off on a good footing. You know, some money or some assets or, you know, whatever. Land or, you know, some means. So that they at least they can begin, you know, with, not in a poverty-stricken condition, but they can begin, you know, with something that they can build upon. That was the idea. So it was considered the duty of the father of the girl to provide some means so that, you know, the new husband then he would be able to provide for the man's daughter properly and then develop, you know, the family life in a peaceful way. That was the principle of a dowry. Later on, now you see that, you know, the exploitation part of it is that if the girl doesn't come with a dowry, then they harass them. Yeah, the parents of the sons, they harass the daughter-in-law. Oh, you came with no dowry? Where is your dowry? Go back and get something. We want a car, we want a fridge, we want a, you know, a TV, we want 10 lakhs or 1 lakh or whatever it is. And if the girl's parents don't provide the dowry, I mean, there's horrendous things that are done to these poor girls. Huh? Yes, sometimes they're killed. Sometimes, oh, this girl didn't bring anything. She's just a burden. So, all right, burn her. Pour some kerosene on her. Oh, she was an accident in the kitchen. She got burnt to death. Now let's find another one that has a dowry. That's going on. So, therefore, it was banned. So the social conditions are not supportive of many things that are there, you know, that were principles of Vedic culture. And so you can't really practice them anymore. If you can change society and bring them back, you know, to a system of cooperation rather than a system of exploitation, then some of these things can be done. But, you know, similarly with like young girls getting married, it's become a system of exploitation rather than of spiritual principle. In India now, they're changing more to the West. Dowries, of course, were banned many years ago. Child marriages are banned. 18 actually, I think, is the legal age now in India. 18. So it's changing a little bit. But they're not supplying any solutions either, just by passing laws. Because the problem is that the impulses are still there. Even if a girl doesn't get married, you know, or a boy doesn't get married when they're 14 or 16 or whatever it is, the impulses are still there. You haven't solved the problem just by banning, you know, so-called child marriages. So they're not, you know, they're getting rid of one system, but they're not introducing an alternative, you know, which is beneficial. Basically what happens is that then the kids are just left to their own means. And they end up getting exploited anyway. If we can make a nice Vedic culture, that would be good. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says that you cannot recreate Vedic culture as it was in the past. It's not possible. So therefore, Prabhupada tried to just extract the main spiritual principles. And that will compensate for any lack of, you know, Vedic social organization, if the spiritual principle is strong. Morari.
The problem with dowry is actually on both sides, because many times the girl's family promise so much so that they will give the husband, and they don't pay it.
Yeah.
They're giving their word and then they don't do it.
Yes. Morari is saying there that sometimes, because it works the other way, that the girl's parents make so many promises just to get the girl married so that they don't have to have the burden of looking after her anymore. And then once they've dumped her on the other family, then they don't give any dowry, and then the other family gets angry, and then there's fighting. So it's, you know, that's exploitation. And of course the dowry was not meant to go in the pockets of the parents. The dowry was actually meant for the boy and girl to set them up, you know, so that they could live a happy life. But nowadays the dowry is, or the dowry has to come to the parents. You know, it's like, it's just a mundane material transaction, that's all, monetary transaction. It's almost like selling your daughter off, you know, for a fridge and a car or something. Right. Yes, I was with Prabhupada in, I think, September or October of 76 in Vrindavan, when he told me that. But he said if the husband and wife are actually Krishna conscious, there's no need to separate. They can remain together. Yeah? Because they're Krishna conscious, that's the whole point of it. So, taking sannyas, or, you know, vanaprastha, these are external considerations. Yeah, if there's a certain point at which, you know, the children have grown up, there's no necessity for the parents to earn money to support them anymore. They're left just with themselves again. Now, if the man and woman are too much attached to each other, materially attached, then it's nice if they can gradually separate. Yeah. To get away from that principle of sex attraction. But if they're together and that principle is slackened, and they're just naturally, you know, becoming more Krishna conscious, then naturally the sex desire is reducing, then there's no need to separate. Sannyas is, you know, it's part of a mundane system. It's the last step towards, you know, spiritual life. But in and of itself, it's not necessarily spiritual. At least not from a Krishna conscious point of view. Because complete renunciation, you can say, is the first step towards, you know, spiritual life. But just the act of accepting, you know, sannyas doesn't necessarily, you know, make you fully Krishna conscious. If you're Krishna conscious, you're automatically renounced anyway. And then the external, you know, show of renunciation, or practice of it, is not necessary.
Part of the reason why I brought it up is that, just like the one you shared in the Manipas part, if there is a need, there will be, it's not going for a society to discuss it as much as household, your husband, because of the Asian people. Part of the Manipas is also staying together, so it doesn't necessarily need to be in the household. So that's probably enough said on my part.
Yeah. Well, now we're at that stage where a lot of the devotees are like us. They're getting into, you know, late 50s, early 60s. Families have grown up. And, you know, we have to figure out what we're going to do with the rest of our lives. So. Well, we're fortunate that Prabhupada has given us, you know, a positive alternative. So we can move out of the family stage of life. We can stay together, but we're working for the pleasure of Krishna. There's so many activities that we can get involved in. All right, now we don't have to go out and earn as much money as we used to have to. The kids have grown up, they're earning their own money, looking after themselves. So what shall we do with our time and energy? And there's so many activities in ISKCON that we can do for preaching, you know, book distribution, deity worship, in various different ways. So it's nice, you know. And at the same time, husband and wife, they don't necessarily have to separate. You know, that becomes another headache sometimes. You know. Yes? For Brahmins. Not necessarily. Prabhupada said that at least the Brahmins and sometimes the Kshatriyas also, they can take sannyas. Not always, but sometimes they do that. Especially the Brahmins, they move into sannyas. But sometimes the Kshatriyas also would do that. But definitely not for the Vaishyas. For the Vaishyas, they can become up to Vanaprastha. And the Shudras, nothing. You just remain married, that's it. Well, I don't know of any, but I do know that Prabhupada told me that, so it is possible. Yeah. For Kshatriyas, they can sometimes take up to the sannyas stage, but not the Vaishyas and the Shudras, nothing. They just, you know, they remain married, that's it. Gyana. Sometimes you can't preach to somebody. It doesn't work. Sometimes people get such a strong and powerful impetus for something that no matter how many good words you shower upon them, they're incapable of acting upon it. So he just deduced that in this particular circumstance, it was better to go ahead with her request. From one point of view, because, as I've explained, and as he was saying in this verse, you know, if our relationship becomes disturbed, if it becomes broken, we both lose. You are the, you know, the our principle of our marriage is the principle of liberation. Yeah. So in that respect, then I should satisfy you. I should keep you happy. That was his overall consideration here. Of course, at the same time, you know, he's a great yogi, advanced personality. He knew what personalities were going to be born from their combination. Yeah, that they were going to combine at an inauspicious time, in an, you know, at the wrong circumstance. He knew very well what kind of personalities were going to be born from this, but he also knew that those personalities and their births were going to serve a higher purpose for the Lord also. So there's a lot of different factors going on there. And he knew at the time, okay, my wife is so disturbed, she's not going to listen to anything that I'm going to tell her right now anyway. So you have to be practical sometimes. And in due course of time, if the intent is proper, even if an immediate action is improper, but if there's an overall intent, that intent will exert itself at a later stage. And then whatever, you know, is misdeed is done here, in due course of time it will be corrected up here. So yeah, you know, there's a wide view on that. Yes, Guru.
Yes.
There's always, especially with, you know, incidents like this, when you're dealing with, you know, exalted personalities like, you know, Kasyapa and Diti and whatever, there's many different angles of vision, and it depends on, you know, what social standpoint or spiritual standpoint that you want to choose to make your commentary from. Yeah, so you can see, you can criticize it, or you could, you know, you could praise the same action, you know, depending on how you want to view it. All right, we better finish, sir. It's very late. Shilla Prabhupada ki jai.